Iran reiterates that it will continue to support Palestinians in their fight against Israel. A Palestinian NGO says some 170 journalists have been injured in Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. And new footage emerges of the fatal arrest of a black man in the U.S. state of Louisiana in 2019. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the first story takes us right here in Iran, where the chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has reiterated Iran's support for Palestine after the victory of resistance factions in the Gaza Strip against the recent Israeli aggression. Major General Hossein Salami made the remark in telephone calls with Ismail Haniyeh and Ziad Nakhlallah, leaders of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad resistance movement. Salami called the victory of the Palestinian resistance a divine miracle. He said Israeli defeat is not only a defeat for the Zionists, but for their backers, especially the U.S. and Britain, as well as other despicable regimes that sought to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. The IRGC chief said the Palestinian victory has shown that Israel is on the verge of collapse. Palestinian leaders, for their part, appreciate the Islamic Republic's firm stance and support for the Palestinian nation and resistance forces. Iran's top general says Palestinians' triumph in the face of Israeli aggression against Gaza shows that the existence of the occupying regime is under the thumb of resistance groups. Well, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces says Palestinians are dictating their will on the Tel Aviv regime more forcefully than ever, putting it in a position of weakness and vulnerability. Major General Mohammad Bagheri expressed confidence that the countdown for the collapse of the criminal Israeli regime is nearing its end. He called on Israel's supporters and the Arab states, which have normalized relations with Tel Aviv, to renounce their collusion with the regime as soon as possible. Bagheri vowed that the Iranian armed forces will not waver in their support for Palestinians and consider the liberation of Palestinian territories as their mission. Meanwhile, Iranians have taken to the streets for a second day in Tehran to celebrate the victory of Palestinians against the Israeli regime after that ceasefire came into effect between the two sides. Saman Khojouri brings us more.
Iranians have gathered in central Tehran on Saturday to commemorate the victory of Palestinians against Israel after a ceasefire came into force between Hamas and Israel, which ended nearly 2 weeks of violence against the Gaza Strip.
We are celebrating the victory of Palestinians against Israeli forces. Resistance forces have grown so powerful that Israel cannot drag a war for more than 10 to 15 days anymore. It cannot tolerate the resistance and solidarity of Palestinians. This is a victory for the Islamic world.
Scores of Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed and hundreds more injured in the Israeli shelling of residential areas in Gaza. The Gaza-based Hamas movement has retaliated by firing thousands of rockets targeting Israeli settlements, military sites, and occupied cities.
We have gathered here to show our solidarity with the Palestinian nation and celebrate the victory of Palestinian resistance groups against Israel. The ceasefire showed that the Israeli regime could not tolerate the attack by Hamas forces.
I have come here to announce to the world that we stand by our brothers and sisters in Palestine, and we will never forget them. This is a chance now to celebrate their victory.
Earlier on Friday, Iranians took to the streets in car convoys to celebrate the occasion. Iranian ralliers here say Palestinians will respond to Israeli weapons with rockets and not stones. However, they say awareness-raising campaigns like such demonstrations act as a powerful weapon by letting the world know about the Israeli atrocities and crimes against Palestinians.
As Israel was forced to accept a ceasefire, Palestinians believe that resistance is still the only way to put an end to Israeli violation of Palestinian rights and its atrocities in the occupied lands. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A Palestinian NGO says some 170 journalists have been injured in the latest Israeli attacks on Gaza and occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian Journalist Syndicate says 70 journalists were wounded during Israeli assaults on Gaza. The syndicate added around 100 journalists were injured during attacks in the West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds, and one Palestinian journalist was killed while offices of 33 media organizations were destroyed. The syndicate is filing a complaint about Israeli crimes against journalists to be presented to the International Criminal Court. Reporters Without Borders says Israeli airstrikes on the media in Gaza amount to war crimes. At least 279 Palestinians were killed, including 69 children, in Israeli attacks on Gaza since May the 10th. A ceasefire came into effect early on Friday. Nationwide Palestine Day protests have been held across Pakistan in solidarity with Palestinians. Demonstrations were held in Islamabad, Karachi, Lahore, and several other cities following Friday prayers. Javed Rana brings us more from Islamabad.
Anti-Israel sermons were delivered in Islamic schools across Pakistan. Tens of thousands of people came on the streets alone in Islamabad to voice their support for the Palestinian people. There were similar rallies in other major urban centers to protest over Israel's latest round of nearly 2 weeks long attacks on the Gaza Strip, which left scores of Palestinians dead, many of them women and children. Officially, Pakistan observed the Friday as a Palestinian day to express solidarity with the innocent Palestinians. On the streets, people in Pakistan rage with anger like elsewhere in the Muslim world since Israel attacked and desecrated Islam's third holiest mosque after forcible eviction of Palestinian residents in eastern Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and subsequent unilateral war it imposed on Gaza.
I want for government, he declared jihad. There is the only one solution to liberate Palestinian. It's only way jihad.
The disappointment and feeling of hopelessness among people against Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, are growing to a tipping point. No longer people in Pakistan seem to be taking 57-member bloc of Muslim countries as their genuine representative body. People in this protest believe that OIC's inaction has emboldened Israel's aggression upon unarmed Palestinians. Therefore, they want Pakistan and other willing Muslim countries for a joint military action against Israel. This demand was partially echoed during a recently held conference of foreign ministers of OIC, where some of the non-Arab states proposed to set up an international force of protection to prevent similar aggression by Israel in future. Not everywhere in Pakistan, the pro-Palestinian rallies were safe. At least six were killed and over a dozen others were injured after a bomb attack hit a rally in Chaman, southwest of Pakistan. Many suspect pro-Israel terrorist group behind the terror attack.
They want to prevent Pakistani public to attend these rallies. These elements, they fear that if Pakistani public attend these rallies, Pakistani government will get under pressure and they will definitely do something against Israel.
Anti-Israel sentiments run high in Pakistan, given the regime's policy of systematically killing innocent Palestinians and evicting them from their homes over the course of decades. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Afghanistan's Ministry of Defense says security forces have killed around 100 Taliban militants and injured nearly 50 of them across the country. Now, the Afghan army has also defused 34 improvised explosive devices belonging to the Taliban. Fighting between the two sides has recently resumed following a three-day ceasefire during the Eid al-Fitr holidays. While the war-torn country has seen a rise in violence since the U.S.'s failure to fully withdraw its forces by a May 1st deadline, Earlier this week, at least 9 people were killed after a roadside bomb ripped through a vehicle in the southern Helmand province. Also on May the 8th, a bomb explosion outside of a school killed 85 people, many of them schoolgirls. Well, new footage has emerged of the fatal arrest of a black man in the U.S. state of Louisiana in May of 2019.
Let me see your fucking hands! I'm scared! Get out of the car! I'm scared! Get out of the car! I'm your brother! I'm scared! Get
out of the car! 49-year-old Ronald Green was punched and stunned multiple times and later left shackled face down during his violent apprehension following a car chase. Green repeatedly pled with police, who left him handcuffed and unattended for more than 9 minutes. An autopsy suggests the black man's death was partly due to physical struggle, inflicted head injuries, and restraint. Green's family attorney has requested federal indictment for the officers involved in the case. Louisiana State Police are also facing criticism for their late release of the footage showing Green's arrest. Moving on to other news, now turning to Germany, which says it will impose a 2-week quarantine on any traveler entering from Britain, even if they test negative for coronavirus. The Robert Koch Institute, a federal disease control and prevention body, made the announcement after declaring the UK a COVID risk area. It said airlines, buses, and railroad companies are not allowed to bring any passengers other than German citizens and residents from Britain. The measure comes amid warnings by German officials against the spread of an Indian variant of COVID-19 in the UK. Germany has also enlisted 11 other countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America in the category of coronavirus high-risk zones. More than 87,000 people have so far lost their lives to the coronavirus in Germany. The country's total caseload currently stands at over 3.6 million. And now to India, where the coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll, as the country is coping with a whopping number of fatalities and infections. India reported well over 257,000 new cases on Saturday, bringing the overall caseload to nearly 26.3 million. New daily deaths also stayed at more than 4,000. Now the total number of fatalities in the country has near 296,000. Despite the growing number of deaths, cases have seen a downward trend over the past couple of days amid partial or complete lockdowns in most states. India has been struggling with the health crisis since April, when a more virulent second wave of infections hit the country. Now the vaccination process is underway, but the campaign faces major challenges due to limited supplies of doses. And the number of COVID-19 deaths in Latin America and the Caribbean has surpassed a grim milestone of 1 million. A tally based on official figures indicates that more than 90% of deaths have occurred in the region's most populous nations. They include Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, and Peru. That account for 70% of the region's population. Over 31.5 million people have also been infected in Latin America and the Caribbean since the start of the pandemic. The Pan American Health Organization has voiced concern over the slow process of vaccinations. The organization says the pandemic is far from over, but only 3% of the region's population has been immunized so far. Now, Brazil is the hardest hit with nearly 450,000 fatalities. And the World Health Organization has once again voiced concern about coronavirus vaccine inequality in Africa, as only a small majority have received a COVID-19 jab so far.
So when we look at access to the vaccines, we see great inequalities across countries. Seychelles is one of the most vaccinated countries in the world, with 67% of the population having received at least one dose. In Morocco, they've reached 21.9%. And in Mauritius, 17%. Whereas in 14 African countries, less than 1% of the population has received a single dose, and in 4 countries, vaccination hasn't started at all.
Mashidiso Moiti said the time is running out for African countries to close the gap on vaccine inequality. She stated that the continent was expected to receive 66 million vaccine doses through the COVAX initiative from February to May. However, it only received 18.2 million doses. Moiti noted that only 2% of Africans have been vaccinated so far. That's while high-income countries have a vaccination rate of over 80%. The WHO official also called for emergency action to finance Africa's COVID-19 vaccine rollout. Political commentator Abiyomi Azikiwe says an international program is needed to carry out massive vaccinations in order to contain the spread of the coronavirus.
There's been, of course, disproportionate economic and political power. The Western countries, particularly the United States, which has been producing an enormous amount of vaccines, now have a problem of oversupply. Because they have not been able to convince people in certain communities, even oppressed communities, to participate in the vaccination programs. But as Dr. Masadiso Mwete, who is the regional director for the WHO in Africa, said, it's clearly something that has to be addressed. This pandemic cannot be arrested on a regional level. It has to be an international program to carry out massive vaccinations to create some type of herd immunity in order to arrest the spread of the virus. We can see that happening in some communities in the United States, but in other communities, there's still far too many cases, and people are still being hospitalized for COVID-19.
Myanmar's junta has threatened to dissolve the political party of ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi over alleged voter fraud in the 2020 election. An official says the junta's investigation into November's election result is almost complete. They might either dissolve the party or charge party members who committed illegal activities in the vote. The military ousted Suu Kyi and took power on February the 1st, citing alleged fraud in the poll won by Suu Kyi's party in a landslide. Suu Kyi is expected to appear in court on Monday for the first time after weeks of delay with her legal case. Myanmar has been in chaos and its economy paralyzed since the coup. More than 800 people have died in the military crackdown on protesters. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. When the protests started in the streets of Denver, Colorado last spring, days after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, I watched dozens of people marching with anguish and affliction on their faces. Several of them were crying or clearly had been. When I watched the video of the final moments of George Floyd's life, I myself felt the telltale symptoms of grief, a clenched stomach, a surge of adrenaline, and an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. The article you're about to hear has been written by David W. McIver, an associate professor of political science at Colorado State University and the author of Mourning in America, Race and the Politics of Loss. The piece is titled, May 25th Should Be a Day of Mourning for George Floyd. Stay with us for more of David McIver's article. When the protests started in the streets of Denver, Colorado last spring, days after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, I watched dozens of people marching with anguish and affliction on their faces. Several of them were crying, or clearly had been. When I watched the video of the final moments of George Floyd's life, I myself felt the telltale symptoms of grief: a clenched stomach, a surge of adrenaline, and an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. As they unfolded over the next days and weeks, the protests seemed like a moment when black grief, a feeling familiar for black Americans after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Trayvon Martin, Emmett Till, and so many others, might finally become collective grief for the rest of America. The crowds were multiracial, united, emotive, insistent. They marched night after night, giving the unfolding events of last May and June a dreamlike quality, magnified by the fact that they took place in the similarly surreal days of COVID-19 lockdowns. It was a time full of unexpected surprises. Minneapolis said it would dismantle its police department. Deep uncertainty, can it do that? And wild swings between hope and anguish. Possibility and anxiety. Maybe it was just a moment, though, a brief disruption of a relatively unchanging situation. Violence against black lives has continued since the day George Floyd was murdered. Meanwhile, the brief and striking shift in public opinion towards the Black Lives Matter social movement steadily declined, especially among white Americans. Political debate and partisan identities have returned to their familiar polarized pattern. Popular discourse once again largely dissociates from black pain. One year later, it is easy to be cynical about this moment of collective grief. But there is another way of thinking about this, that is still possible to build on the moment of shared grief over the death of George Floyd in order to see a way towards a more democratic and just coexistence. There is an intimate yet still unexplored relationship between mourning and democracy. We tend to see mourning as a temporary disruption of normal life, a cycle of pain, denial, and eventually acceptance. This picture is both right and wrong. Mourning is a movement towards wholeness by way of acknowledging brokenness, but it is less a terminable process than a way of being in the world. To see this better, we have to appreciate the role that attachment and ambivalence play in mourning. Mourning implies attachment. We mourn only for those to whom we are connected, or for that to which we are committed. In the case of George Floyd, who became a public figure only through his death, the communal mourning that followed was less about the specific life that was lost than the democratic ideals that were so clearly violated, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that was extinguished for Mr. Floyd and for too many others. Public mourning, then, is the expression of grief when the longing for social recognition and equal justice is unrequited. Mourning also confronts us with an experience of ambivalence. It is a pivot between life and death, past and future, love and hatred, openness and defensiveness, and reparation and destruction. A democratic politics of mourning implies not only the clarification of our public ideals and commitments, our civic attachments, but also a wrestling with the ambivalence in American history and American psyches. Mourning is the work not only of integrating what has been lost into our personality, but also of integrating the personality itself. Our fears and our hopes, our vulnerabilities and our power. To do this, we first have to overcome the defenses that dissociate us from the pain of loss, our own pain and that of others. Often in times of grief, narratives of innocence and immorality, of absolute good and abject evil, deflect or defend against an experience of ambivalence. Instead of a complex picture of identity and history that might inspire dialogue and collaborative action, the raw energy of mourning is channeled through the quick and relatively easy identification of scapegoats or magical fixes. But public mourning can also manifest something different, precisely because it can open up a dreamlike space of possibility. This is what the psychoanalyst Dr. D.W. Winnicott called potential space. For Dr. Winnicott, cultural activities like a protest, although he did not use that example, are both real and surreal. They take place in the realm of shared reality, but they are not reducible to this reality because they are also imbued with aspects of dreaming, such as free association, playful juxtaposition, and a fluid sense of time. It is the dreamlike nature of cultural life that makes creativity possible, what Dr. Winnicott linked to play. Following Dr. Winnicott, we see mourning as a space where we acknowledge loss and ambivalence by playing with the possibilities for different, more creative responses to loss. And this brings me back to the George Floyd protests. The initial protests occurred in potential space, a mixture of dream and reality, and despite the resumption of familiar discourses in their wake, there are signs that new possibilities have emerged from that moment. For example, there is a notable spike of interest in truth and reconciliation processes and racial equity initiatives. The Divided Community Project at the Ohio State University recently published a practical guide for such initiatives, which could take place in networks of civic associations, within school districts, or at municipal, state, or national levels. No doubt, any such efforts would be imperfect, but they would also represent tentative steps into a democratic work of mourning with unknown consequences. What we do know is that conversations across social difference can result in greater levels of understanding and trust. We have a proof of concept, but we can lack larger structures or rituals of this kind of work. Yet a hunger for those labors clearly exists, which can be built upon. What would happen if we thought creatively about how to mourn as a society? George Floyd's story is inseparable from his tragic death, and any commemoration should not shy away from the fact. So one possibility would be to make 25th of May, the day that George Floyd was murdered, a day of both public commemoration and public reflection. It could help highlight the ongoing dysfunctions of American democracy while creating opportunities for public dialogue and public work. It could be a day of protest and service. In light of America's tragic history and its continuing challenges of violence, disrespect, and unequal access to liberty, 25th of May could become a day of public mourning, understood as a space for sharing not just grief about the present world, but also aspirations for a world that Americans could build together. a day of mourning would open up potential spaces in American politics, even if momentarily, and recapture some of the dreamlike quality of that brief time when, after George Floyd's murder, another world seemed possible.
Africa Today.
Protests and demonstrations have continued to rock Chad following a military takeover after veteran ruler Idriss Déby Itno died fighting rebels. Many have taken to the streets of the capital in N'Djamena rejecting the installation of Mahamat Idriss Déby, the son of the late president, as the head of the transitional authority. Now, the masses want the military to step down in favor of a civilian leadership.
We're in a country where human dignity is flouted, and we have had enough. We have suffered a lot, and now it's enough. We want the military power to leave and to let us choose our leaders freely. We are not puppets. We are tired.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, which will focus on the unfolding crisis in Chad, where the governing military council is cracking down on angry protesters who are defying a ban to demonstrate against the junta that took over power in violation of Chad's constitution. Now, in the second segment of our show, we shall talk about the renewed push to return the famous Benin bronzes looted by Britain during its colonial rule in Nigeria. But why are Nigerians demanding the return of these sculptures? A Nigerian curator here explains.
Edo people, it's important for Nigerians, and it's important for Africans, because it's a huge testimony of our history, of our culture, and of the exquisite craftsmanship that produced these masterpieces.
Join us for more till the end of our show and send us your views and opinion as you watch.
Trouble in Chad. The newly re-elected president of Chad, Idriss Déby, died of wounds he suffered on the front line while commanding his army in battles against rebels in the north last April. The shock news of Debbie's death came only the day after the 68-year-old career military man was proclaimed the winner of a presidential election that had given him a sixth term in office. In the aftermath of the death of Idriss Déby, who ruled with an iron fist for three decades, his 37-year-old son, Mohamed Déby, was installed as chairman of the Transitional Military Council of Chad. The military takeover has triggered protests, with Chadians insisting that the country is not a monarchy and that the constitution should be followed. Several people have been killed by security forces during protests. A resident of N'Djamena explains here why they came out to protest.
They talk about democracy in theory, but on the ground there's no democracy. That's why people came out today, to protest and demand their rights, because we're fed up.
Now, in a bid to prevent the situation from escalating out of control, the chairman of the Military Council of Chad, Mohamed Déby, has called for dialogue.
Ces valeurs si chères à notre défunt président seront éprouvées.
These values, so dear to our late president, will be demonstrated and enshrined in the framework of an inclusive national dialogue that will be organized during this transition period. I will be the guarantor of this dialogue, which will not shy away from any subject of national interest, according to a precise timetable that the government will be called upon to reveal.
Now, former colonial power France has come under sharp criticism for backing the illegal military takeover in Chad for its own vested interests in this north-central African nation. Now, for an incisive analysis on the situation in Chad, we are joined by Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy and history. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, what is the current situation in Chad after the killing of Deby and the appointment of his son as the interim president?
It's very tense because there is opposition to the establishment of a transitional military council. The president of the National Assembly was slated to take power in the country in the event of the assassination or the incapacitation of the president. That did not happen. And it's still not clear exactly under what circumstances President Idriss Debe Itno was killed. The government said he sustained injuries while on the front line against the FACT rebels, yet no specific information has been released to the international press.
Thanks for that, Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire.
37-year-old Mohamed Idriss Deby, a four-star general, is in charge of the Transitional Military Council, which was formed after his father's death. He is therefore acting as the de facto interim president of Chad for a period of 18 months. According to Chad's constitution, which was suspended by the military, the Speaker of the Parliament must take over when a sitting president dies before elections can be held. Leading opposition parties in Chad have rejected the military takeover.
Voici la déclaration officielle du Haut Commandement.
Chad is not a monarchy. There can be no dynastic devolution of power in our country.
Now, under Chadian law, the Speaker of Parliament should have taken power after Deby's death and not his son. Now, why did the army refuse to obey the constitution?
There is concern about the overall stability inside the country. Chad has been a bulwark of France and the United States in their efforts, so-called counterterrorism campaigns in Central and West Africa. There was some trepidation in regard to moving forward with the same political dispensation. The son of the president, 37-year-old Mahatma Debe Itno, was appointed as the chairperson of a transitional military council. Now, it appears to people on the outside of the country and many inside the country that this was a coup d'etat because they did not follow the constitutional protocols that were voted on by the Chadian people. So it's a very serious issue, and also internationally, the African Union wants some movement in regard to the current regime that is operating now in Chad.
Idriss Deby, who came to power in a rebellion in 1990, was an important Western ally in Africa for three decades. He facilitated military intervention by France and the US in Africa. Following the death of this veteran ruler, White House offered sincere condolences while France said it had lost a brave friend. Now, to underscore the importance of Chad to France, Emmanuel Macron was among the foreign dignitaries who attended Idriss Deby's funeral in N'Djamena. Now, Mr. Azikiwe, as you mentioned earlier, Idriss Deby was a darling of Western powers, especially the United States and France. What are the interests of these imperialist powers in Chad?
Chad is a oil-producing state. It is also located on the border of a number of important countries, such as the Lake Chad Basin region, where Nigeria is located, and Cameroon, which are huge oil-producing states. Also, former President Debe was willing to utilize his military forces as a conduit for AFRICOM, United States Africa Command, and also Operation Barkhane, which is a French military operation in West and Central Africa. And both these militaries are there to represent the interests of Washington, Wall Street, and Paris. They claim they're in the region to strengthen the security capabilities of various African nations so they can fight against Islamic terrorism. But as many people already know, a lot of the groups that are said to be terrorists previously have been supported by the U.S.
Idris Deby died of his injuries following clashes with rebels belonging to a group calling itself FACT, or the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, in the northern part of the Central African country. Founded in 2016 by former army officers, the group, like opposition politicians and rights groups in Chad, accused Deby of repression in the run-up to the election. These rebels built up their base in Libya in the Tibesti Mountains, which straddle northern Chad and part of southern Libya. How powerful is the rebel group that killed President Deby?
They were previously based in neighboring Libya. They were allied with Khalifa Haftar, who is the head of the Libyan National Army. And, of course, Haftar have been for many years, decades even, an asset of the United States Central Intelligence Agency. Since 2011, he was flown back to Libya during the counter-revolution against the previous Jemahiriya government under Colonel Gaddafi. When Gaddafi was overthrown and killed, Haftar made several bids to take control in Tripoli, all of which were unsuccessful. Now there's a new United Nations-appointed government of national unity in Tripoli, and it's interesting that this FACT rebel group left the country in the immediate aftermath of the establishment of this UN-appointed government.
Idris Deby established ties with the Israeli regime, which provided him with weapons to sustain his brutal grip on power. Chad is among several African countries utilizing deadly weapons acquired from the Israeli regime that are used for repression and other human rights violations.
Now, the Israeli regime fueled the conflict in Chad by supplying Idris Deby with weapons and thus enabled him to extend his dictatorship. Now, can you elaborate further on the role of the Israeli regime in destabilizing Chad?
Since 2016, there have been contacts between the State of Israel and the Debe administration. Foreign Ministry had visited Chad in 2016. In 2018, the late President Debe visited Israel. Israel has supplied intelligence assistance as well as weaponry to the Chadian military, which serves as a linchpin in terms of providing ground troops for all these military operations that are going on in Central and West Africa over the last several years. So Israel is very much involved because they want to, of course, be involved in Africa as well because of the strategic resources and also in an attempt to undermine the Palestinian struggle and the struggle in Syria.
Now, the aftershocks of the death of Idris Deby Itno on April 20 are only beginning to appear. The future of Chad remains fragile and uncertain. Instability in Chad is bound to have far-reaching repercussions across the Sahel region. Now, a resident here expresses fear of clashes between the military and rebels.
War destroys the country. Now there are soldiers who confiscated power, and those guys over there are saying they are going to come. We don't agree. If they come, there must be a dialogue.
Now, Mr. Azikiwe, several people have been killed protesting against the military junta. Now, should we expect a turbulent and violent transition period?
It depends on the political and social balance of forces. It appears as if there's unease in the country among the working people, the youth, and farmers inside the country, and perhaps even elements within the military as well, that this new government was installed without any consultation or any participation on the existing political parties as well as the National Assembly.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe, for your insight. Now we shall take a short break. And when we come back, we shall talk about how Western countries are reluctant to return Benin bronzes looted during the British colonial period. Now, don't go away.
muted Benin bronzes in the West.
In 1897, British colonial forces razed Benin City, massacring an unknown number of people and bringing a violent end to the Kingdom of Benin, which had thrived for centuries as one of West Africa's major powers. Now, during the raid, British troops looted at least 3,000 precious items made by the Edo people.
The looted items included ivory statues, carved elephant tusks, ceramics, masks, carved portraits of kings, and more than 1,000 intricately decorated brass plaques that once adorned ancestral altars and court buildings in the city's royal palace. Benin City, situated in modern-day southern Nigeria, was famed for its specialist bronze sculpting guilds, groups of skilled artisans that produced works of huge historic and cultural importance. The looted bronze statues have spread further and further afield over the years, popping up periodically across Europe and the United States. Now they're increasing calls for the return of these precious cultural heritage items.
We want outright return of those things here. They belong here. This is where they were made, and we know the purpose, the reason why we made them.
Now, to discuss the return of these looted cultural heritage items belonging to the people of Benin in Nigeria, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot, Mr. Mbaluto, and it's great having you. Now, first, can you tell us how important are the Benin bronzes to the people of Nigeria and Africa, actually, in general?
Very, very important, because most of the artifacts or even sculptures represent the cultural mix, the cultural heritage of a country. And therefore, when you talk about all these bronzes, they represent the culture of Benin City, you know, everybody from that particular country where they were taken from. They also represent, like, the history, the heritage of the Kingdom of Benin. We are speaking right now of the British Museum has got about 900 pieces of that. Benin court has requested them to be taken back, but the negotiations are still ongoing. That's where we are with that.
Julius Mbaluto, the African Affairs Analyst.
Western art historians and museum professionals claim that various forms of danger in the West have historically posed just as much as of a threat to the Benin bronzes as a perceived lack of climatic control found at Nigerian museums.
Now, this is while Africans have been making their artifacts and preserving them for centuries before they were looted by European invaders. Now, some museum professionals claim Nigeria and Africa in general does not have the technical capacity to take care of its cultural heritage. What's your take?
African professionals are capable of doing anything that the Western countries can do, given the chance. And therefore, to say Nigerian professionals are not experts enough to keep is just an insult to adding an insult to injury. What they need to do is just take these artifacts back. They need to just take everything they took from these countries back, because this is part of this country's heritage.
Now, amid mounting calls for restitution, institutions like the British Museum, holder of the world's largest collection of Benin bronzes, have been forced to consider returning the stolen heritage items.
A new museum is being built in Benin City to facilitate this, but as it stands, most of the looted bronzes will only be returned on a temporary, not permanent basis. A resident of Benin City, like most of his compatriots, rejects the preposterous idea of loaning the bronzes instead of permanently returning them.
The question I may ask, is it their own property? Why should you loan my own property to me? You cannot loan my own property to me. You understand? They stole it quite well.
Why are most Western museums insisting on a temporary return of these looted heritage items instead of permanently returning them to where they rightly belong in Africa?
The countries that have held all this, for example, like talk about if you came to London and say, oh, let all this go back to the countries that you came from. most of these museums will be left empty. You know, these museums in London, they make so much money from tourists who go to see all these things. And, you know, the key thing is that it's all about the money involved. And therefore, you find that definitely the wealth they are making, they don't want that to let that go. That's why it's so difficult to get it done.
The people of Nigeria are eager to reconnect with their looted heritage, but it remains to be seen if museums in Western countries will stop their greed and return these looted items of African heritage.
The governor of Edo State, whose capital is Benin City, says talks are ongoing about returns that are expected to be a boost for a broader movement building across Africa and beyond, seeking colonial-era loot.
We would, you know, be open to such conversations. So there's just not one track decision as to whether it's going to be on loan or a permanent return. You know, we will be open to having a broad range of discussions on each piece of work.
Mr. Baluto, last question to you. Now, will the return of these Benin bronzes have a domino effect that will see the eventual return of other African heritage artifacts looted by colonialists?
One of the fears that countries that looted all this wealth from Africa fear, if they say yes to one country, there will be a domino effect. Other countries whose wealth was looted, they'll follow suit. And that has always been my greatest fear. How do I know? Probably. I covered the Mau veterans case in courts in London, which they won. One of the greatest fear was another country would pursue the same line. And it's not just one country, it's many. So the fear of the domino effect is always there, definitely. And yes, we cannot say just this Benin bronze. It's been done successfully in Kenya. There's one of the tribes, Kalenjin. Some artifacts were returned to them. So now that it didn't follow suit, it doesn't mean it cannot follow suit. It depends on how it is done. And depending on how it is done and how successful it becomes, yes, there could be a domino effect. Probably that's why the people who are holding all these artifacts fear.
Well, one thing that should be made clear is that the return of these looted artifacts is not a favor by Western museums to African countries, but it is correcting historical injustices committed against the people of Africa. That's it for this edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.